So today I have the Education Minister, Heike Barata, with us to talk about some new investments we're making into education. I'm going to make some opening remarks, I'm going to drill, pass it to Heike to take any questions on that, and I'll just finish some other remarks I've got, and then take questions on anything you want. So today I'm pleased to announce that the government is investing $27 million in new or expanded programs aimed particularly at lifting up children and young people who are falling behind. As you know, on average, 4 out of 5 children are successfully getting the qualifications they need from school, which is great news. But our education system continues to underperform for many Māori and Pacifica children and children from low socioeconomic backgrounds. Our government is working very hard to change that. We have introduced better public service targets at early childhood and secondary school level. We want to see 98% of children starting school having participated in early childhood education in 2016, and 85% of 18-year-olds having achieved NCEA Level 2 or an equivalent qualification by 2017. We're making good progress with around about 96% of children currently participating in early childhood education and 77% of 18-year-olds achieving NCEA Level 2, up nearly 3% on 2011. We've also introduced national standards so that we can see how children are doing at primary and intermediate school and then identify pretty early on who's falling behind. All of this data has allowed us to get a clearer picture of our education system and see where we can better target resources. The $27 million investment we're announcing today is targeted at those children who are falling behind. We know that the most critical period of learning in a child's life occurs between birth and 8 years of age. If opportunities to learn basic skills are missed during this time, then the child can struggle throughout their whole education. Today I can announce we are investing significantly in this area. We are trialling new literacy and numeracy programs which are designed to help parents teach their children to read and write and of course do maths. We are spending $3 million on expanding the successful Mutu Karoa program, which focuses on ensuring children's develop really good literacy and numeracy skills in their first year of school. This program is already achieving some great results. In South Auckland, where it's been operating in 10 schools, there are significantly more kids at or above the national standard level. At Sylvia Park School, there's been a significant lift in achievement for children in years 1 and 2. Thanks to the government focus on data, we now know exactly where young people are who are in danger of disengaging education are located. One of the things we are intending to do is to reach our better public service target for NCEA Level 2 work, is to work with 141 secondary schools who have significant potential for improvement. These schools will receive money from the newly established $2.8 million Achievement Fund, which will allow them to focus on young people who are in danger of missing out on NCEA Level 2. Schools might use this money to establish summer programs or homework groups. The Ministry of Education has employed 13 highly experienced secondary school leaders to work alongside those schools to increase achievement. We are also investing over $13 million in programs targeted at Māori and Pacifica students, including the Pacifica Education Plan. Across these programs, the government is making sure there are lots of resources for parents to help them talk to teachers about their child's progress and help them support their children's learning. These new and expanded programs aim to ensure all young New Zealanders leave school with the skills they need to reach their potential in the modern world. So we'll hand over to Heike and then start with some questions.
Kia ora, good afternoon. As the Prime Minister said, we are investing $27 million in new or expanded programs to continue our government's drive to raise achievement for 5 out of 5 New Zealand children and young people. We've been developing a very data-rich environment that, together with schools' own experiences and expert reviews, help us more precisely target existing programs or design and deliver new initiatives and the resources to support them. We've been developing an approach in the Ministry of Education that moves from statistics across the system to actual numbers of girls and boys, to the schools they are in, their names and their particular needs. So from numbers to names to needs. This suite of investments reflects that targeted, personalised approach. In fact, there was a story in this morning's Herald that reflected the first lot of work that the Ministry's NCEA Task Force did with a group of schools last year, and great results were produced from it. The schools are excited, and so am I. Last week, the Association of Education, Dr. Sharples, and I provided my cross-sector forum on raising achievement with early copies of the Kahikite and Māori education strategy following our release earlier of the Pacifica Education Plan. The Ministry of Education has since released those on their websites, but we all know that plans in themselves don't mean anything. They're just pieces of paper, like data without information and knowledge is just, a person without information and data is just a person with an opinion. So this government has invested $8 million into new resources to support the programs outlined in those two plans, as well as the package we're announcing today, which is a mix of programs to directly support teachers, but also parents. We know that the two biggest in-school investments we can make that will raise achievement is the quality of teaching and the quality of leadership. But the two biggest outside of schools is the strength of parental engagement with their children and their children's school and the expectations they hold of and for them. So this suite of investments is about as much as engaging parents with their children, whether before school, in helping them to feel confident about reading to their children, in order that their transition from early learning into primary school is as well and as productive as it can be. And that's what the Motu Kaurua initiative, designed and trialled by Sylvia Park School, is all about. How do you engage with parents who are 3 and 4 year olds who are likely to come to your primary school? How do we get them well established in terms of their foundation literacy so that they don't need second wave supplemental aids? There's been a lot of focus in the media on reading recovery recently. It is a supplemental aid. If we get foundation literacy and numeracy right, we don't need so much reliance on these supplemental aids. We're also announcing a program called Building on Success, and it is, as its name suggests, it has cherry-picked those elements of a range of programs that have been very successful, particularly in targeting Māori and Pacifica achievement. And so Te Pitahitanga, which was to have ended at the end of last year, was extended to the end of this year. We've worked with the designers of that to identify exactly which elements within that have been most successful. Te Kākano, Star Path, Gateway, all of which have been successful in different ways. Building on Success takes the best elements of those and, using a differentiated and personalised approach, will work with students across schools in New Zealand. You have, I think, the background paper that sets out what these initiatives are. As the Prime Minister has said, we are we know now from all the data that we are gathering, and it will get better and better, what is working, where it's working, where it isn't, and where we need to focus. We want to work with schools and with parents so that their students and their children can be successful, and we can move from being a country where 4 out of 5 on average are successful to 5 out of 5 being successful. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have. No, this is funding that we've had in across a couple of budgets, which are focused on those students that have consistently not performed as well in the system. So what we've been doing, though, is, for instance, we've been working with the providers of Te Kotahitanga to identify what's worked really well and what hasn't. And through that process, we've now developed this suite of, I think, about 8 or 10 initiatives.
So the money's coming from existing, coming out of it.
It's coming out. It was provided for, a large amount was provided for in budget 2012. In the last 3 budgets, we've identified were either equity funding or priority learners funding, and these ones are coming out of already budgeted for this specific area.
And this is about $9 million a year, isn't it?
Well, it's going to be $27 million over 4 years.
But $9 million a year initially.
Well, some of them are for 2-year programs and some of them are for 4-year programs.
$5 million a year for the first 2.
For which programs? Motu Kaurua is only for 2 years,
yeah.
Whereas Building on Success is for 4 years. So, I mean, if you want to average it over 3 years, then yes, that's what it would amount to. But they're different programs. One is a $2 million program for 2 years. One is an $8 million program for 4 years, etc., etc. But our fact sheet that we've handed out gives the specific breakdown.
Okay, cool. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's just you will have seen the announcement. announcement by Finance Minister Bill English earlier this afternoon, the government has issued a discussion document looking at the options of flexible superannuation. This is part of the confidence and supply agreement between National and the United Future parties. The proposal would give New Zealanders greater choice about when they could first take New Zealand superannuation. For example, they might opt to take it at 60 years of age at a lesser rate, or defer receiving it past 65 in order to receive it at a higher rate. The discussion paper is being issued to gauge New Zealanders' appetite for such flexibility, and more policy work will be needed if there was a decision to go ahead. It's important to remember that in order to provide certainty to those who have already retired and those who will retire in the future, that this government remains committed to maintaining existing settings and entitlements for New Zealand Super. Just next week, I'll lead the New Zealand delegation, including Foreign Affairs Minister Murray McCulley, as we head off to the 44th Pacific Islands Forum in the Republic of the Marshall Islands. As the host nation, the Marshall Islands has highlighted climate change as a major theme for this year's forum. We'll also cover broader issues, including cooperation and integration around the Pacific Plan, Fiji's steps towards its election proposals in 2014, and of course security issues, as well as attending the forum meeting and leaders retreat. I'll hold bilateral meetings with a number of other Pacific leaders and participate in the post-forum dialogue. Finally, on a sporting note, I want to acknowledge that it's been a fantastic couple of days for New Zealand sport. Obviously, start by congratulating Richmond Cora and the All Black team on the convincing victory in the Bledisloe Cup. Dean Barker and Emirates Team New Zealand on the very classy and comprehensive winning of the Louis Vuitton Series. And of course, Lydia Ko, who's achieved that remarkable feat of retaining her LPGA title at the Canadian Open this morning. They've all made a very small country like New Zealand very proud. In terms of my activities this week, I have caucus and question time tomorrow. I'll be in Wellington on Wednesday, have National Party commitments on Thursday, and on Friday I'm heading to Te Puke in the Bay of Plenty. In terms of the House this week, as indicated by the Leader of the House on Thursday afternoon, it's the government's intention to move an urgency motion this week. We intend to progress the Insurance Amendment Bill, the Resource Management Reform Bill, and Patents Bill, amongst a number of other bills at committee stage in first and second readings.
Questions? The focus today is obviously on the Labour Party. Are you concerned that this is going to be the focus for the next 3 weeks and you're not going to get as much attention as you're used to?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it, isn't it? One is, yes, they'll get more attention, and their attention will be focused very heavily on how divided they are as they go through their own sort of series of, you know, political idol or, you know, whatever you might want to call it, some sort of reality TV show. Look, in the end, you know, they'll change their leader because that's now, you know, required. But, you know, they'll still be in the ultimate leader if you might talk as well.
David Cunliffe has recommended you take a long, long holiday to Hawaii. What's your response to that?
Oh, that's lovely of him to make my bookings. I'm sure my wife will follow that advice over Christmas, but we'll be back in the new year.
And also Shane Jones has called you a $50 million gorilla. What do you make of that?
Fair enough. It's already begun, hasn't it? Shane's a good bloke. He won't win, but he's a good bloke.
It should a man who has put porn on his ministerial credit card be fit for running to be PM?
Oh, well, he could be, but I mean, the reality is he's not a serious contender in the race. I mean, it's in the end going to come down to Grant Robertson and David Cunliffe, and both of those are going to take the Labour Party even further to the left. I mean, it's really important that New Zealanders understand it's not the caucus deciding who the leader is, it's the union movement. And the union movement, when they select their new candidate, will want payback time, and that's going to take the Labour Party quite a way to the left with the Greens.
So if you were a Labour
member,
who would you vote for?
I don't want to vote for any of them.
No, but if you were, who would you vote for?
David Shearer.
Who do you think will win?
Don't know. Don't really know. Depend on the union movement, they're deciding the next Labour leader.
It is a Labour party, is it? Is it that unusual for the union movement to actually have someone involved?
Well, it's different, isn't it? I mean, you've now got this, you know, equivalent of sort of parliamentary idol, and they'll go out there and strut their stuff. Actually physically demonstrate to New Zealanders how much they loathe each other. Each party and each camp will go out there and undermine one another. They'll go out and spin stuff and leak stuff about one another, and then at the end of it they'll pretend they're all one big happy family.
But that doesn't answer the question of why is it a surprise that the Labour movement has some influence.
Well, it's different, isn't it? Because they've got that process now. That's way different from the caucus deciding the leader.
Well, I think how people in New Zealand voters actually have a real...
Sorry.
What
to be healthy for New Zealand voters to have a red left and a red right party there? I mean, it's, why do you think that's a bad thing?
Well, I mean, it's certainly going to make a stark contrast at the next election that you really have truly got the far left versus the centre right. The question is that what New Zealanders want? A very big spending, big taxing. Currently, opposition wants to say no to everything. I check that their position's national well, because over the course of the last, you know, five or six years, we will have proven to New Zealanders, one, we can manage the country in very difficult circumstances, global financial crisis, Christchurch earthquakes, you know, Pipe River mines, us, you kind of name it, we've had to work our way through those. We've got very good economic numbers, and numbers across a number of areas, improving health system, improving the education system. Now I'm very confident about our results. They are going to have a prescription which is very far left, and that's just a question of whether New Zealanders want that.
Can we ask you about this ruling from Justice Pankhurst today, just in the insurance issue in Christchurch?
I haven't seen it. I'm sorry, Jess, what did
he
say?
Oh, he basically said that it was against the law for the government to go and purchase uninsured land in Christchurch.
Oh, right, okay.
So he said that that's not...
involuntary acquisition of the red zone.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you think that the government will appeal that?
Look, she said by my reaction, I simply don't know. I mean, one of the issues, of course, is that land in the red zone is by definition, you know, marooned because there's no services being provided there, that won't be provided there. We believe the land is unstable. It was always and is a challenging area, I accept that, because by definition, because it's land, it can't have insurance on it because the insurance comes through EQC and that comes by virtue of a property being built on it. So if there's no property, it can't be insured. So it's always been a bit of a challenge. But we'll need to go away and get some advice about what happens next.
Do you anticipate that the government will now go and look at some kind of new offer?
Well, I don't know. I mean, some of those owners want to sell. I mean, obviously they prefer to sell for more than the government offer, which is 50% of the land value. It depends on when they bought the land. Some instances it's not quite so bad, but some instances, you know, there is hardship there, I accept that actually. But the challenge is, what does the government do when it's really blazing a new trail? Because there was no, there's really no rule book here. You know, essentially, you're taking something out of an uninsured asset, and generally, the government's response is if you don't have insurance, then we're not going to fill the gap there. That's been the dilemma that we've been dealing with.
What are the chances of the government supporting the Peter Dunn's thesis of the scheme?
Oh, it's possible. I mean, the important thing to understand is it's fiscally neutral. So, I mean, if you take, I'm sure this is the way it'll ultimately work, but if you took superannuation, say, at 63, you would get a smaller amount, but the expectation from the actuaries is that you'll get it for longer because, you know, the expectation is we'll all die at this at the same point. You take it later, you obviously get more. So it'd be a trade-off for people to decide whether they think that they could maybe take it a little bit later and get a lot more in their retirement. So it will certainly appeal to some people. And that's one of the issues with the sort of raw arguments of just raising the age of super. I mean, it might work perfectly well for some people who have got office-type jobs. But if you're a lumberjack and you get 65, it's actually pretty tough. Chopping down trees still there.
Is the policy... would it be inconsistent with your commitment not to change the age?
No, because it's voluntary, and every person can continue to receive New Zealand the super at the age of 65, so there's no promise there.
So will that be the first step towards raising the eligibility age, though? Because
I don't think so, no. It's not a Trojan horse for that. I mean, our view is that's not necessary, and we've got modelled in our accounts, and we're quite comfortable that it's affordable in terms of New Zealand super, the current age and entitlement rate. But it is aimed at saying, look, there are a range of different circumstances and some people might want to get, you know, their super later and get more of it.
So how will you decide if you support it or not?
Oh, well, I mean, we'll go through a discussion document, we'll see what people say, we'll see what the experts say, and we'll give it some thought.
So the government said it wouldn't change the eligibility criteria. Do you believe it isn't changing their criteria?
Oh, it's definitely not. I mean, in the end, every New Zealander currently who's been in, you know, been in the country for 10 years or more is entitled to receive 66% of the after-tax average wage in New Zealand super at age 65. That will remain. If they choose to want to take it later and get more, or choose to want to take it earlier and get less, that might be possible if SE super is introduced.
Is this something that you would take potentially to the next election as a proposal?
I don't think we'd need to do that. I mean, in reality, nothing would change. If you're a New Zealander that says, I want to get the current terms and conditions at 65 years of age, there's no change. But it will give some people flexibility, and there definitely will be some people who say, look, I'm going to work till I'm 70, or I'm going to work till I'm 68. I think I take the risk that I pass away in between being 65 and 68, because that's always a risk, and don't get that year of New Zealand Super or 2 years that I might have got. But I also run the opportunity that I might be on the plan for a lot longer, and therefore get a higher amount for a lot longer period of time.
Sounds like you think it's a good idea.
Oh, I think it's not without its merits.
It could be introduced in the next budget.
It's possible, but we'd have to go and do all the work and have all the discussions about that. It takes some time, I think.
Is there any chance that you would revisit your view on 65 and 66% before the election?
No.
Is there a risk that people will get quite good information about what their life expectancy is and therefore it might be cost neutral because some people might be in a different demographic?
Yeah, so that's always the risk, the government would have to work all of that in, but, we know at the moment, roughly, the average woman dies at roughly 82, and the average man roughly dies at 80. So people have to do that calculation, but that's an average, and, any variations.
Prime Minister, on the shooting of Palatau Naitoko, the police have announced 225,000 points.
Yeah.
Is that enough, in your opinion?
That is something the police have agreed. It was obviously a very tragic set of circumstances. And, as the police continue to go with the family, this will never bring their son back, but will at least go some way, I think, to helping support. I think there were dependents that were left, and at least go some way to the police apologising for the tragedy that took place that night.
Does that seem enough for a life, though?
I think it's important to be seen that it's in the context of ACC and other payments that were made, and they depend on the individual circumstances, but I think there might have been a dependent there, even though he was very young at the time. I think the second thing is, look, no amount will ever be enough for a grieving family, and all we can try and do is hopefully learn from that experience. I mean, it was obviously a very difficult set of circumstances that took place that night.
Because the family had planned to sue for $1 million initially. I mean, concernedly, the sort of much lower amount of settlement.
Well, assume they've gone through a settlement process there, and as we all know, suing is very expensive and difficult. And one assumes the parties have come to a point at which there was at least acceptance, if not necessary, full agreement.
Prime Minister, last week the Reserve Bank imposed a speed limit, and the banks have already started reducing interest rates for people who are borrowing less than 80% and increasing it for those above 80%, which seems to sort of worsen the impact on those people who have low deposits. Are you concerned that this is going to hit first-time buyers even harder?
There's, in principle, no logical reason for them to do that. I mean, what they have to do is manage the amount of loans that they write with high LVRs now, and they need to think through how best to manage that. I mean, I still think that they will, on balance overall, tend to favour in the group that are above the 80% LVR that fit within their speed limit. First-time buyers. I think there are a number of good reasons for that. A, because they may be eligible for some of the government's programs, in which case that puts them in a strong position. Or B, because actually, like young people, banks want long-term relationships with clients and customers. First-time buyers are what they could have for a long period of time.
What they're actually doing is cutting their interest rates for those borrowing less than 80%, which tend to be those people who already have a home and built up equity, and increasing the interest rate for those people who are borrowing.
Yeah, we can understand what they're doing. They're trying to build their overall market share, but with a larger group of people under the 80%, so that because it's a percentage, it's 10% of their loans can be above the high LVR. And if they can build the denominator, then that allows them, by definition, to have a higher numerator of first LVRs.
That seems to favour those who are not first home buyers even more.
Yeah, I mean, and look, in the end, there'll be all these things that will go on. People will do, we've got a variety of different. I guess all I'd sort of say is, look, in the end, the Reserve Bank are free to make their decisions. They've made them. They've always had these tools there. They've chosen to use them. My main point would be, my understanding is the bank's done some modelling, and that modelling indicates that by introducing LVR restrictions, they will have to increase interest rates by a small amount than they otherwise would do. That has implications for every borrower and every business in that regard. That is the case, that's good news.
You were hopeful of some kind of card up for first-time buyers, weren't you?
I think in a way we've got a bit of that. I mean, the government's done that funding. And secondly, you know, I think you can already see some of the banks, like one of the banks, for instance, two of them actually, have come out with specific packages aimed at higher lending first home buyers.
There's no actual carve out in the RBNZ rules, is there?
Look, the whole aim here is to reduce some demand, and there is some reduced demand from first home buyers as an effect of this policy. That's likely to be the case, but it's not as if first home buyers are abandoned, they're certainly not.
Just quickly back on the Flexi Super Plan. Would you say that the government has changed its attitude towards the plan in recent times?
We've changed that plan towards New Zealand Super or
changed your attitude towards Mr. Dunn's scheme?
Look, I think it's been like something that he's been interested in for a long period of time. We need to work out whether that would be of enough interest to enough New Zealanders to warrant it, and secondly, whether we can get it to be fiscally neutral in a way which actually sort of adds up. And then you'd have to think about what other parameters, like could someone retire at 55, could they retire at 64? I mean, you know, there's variations in here. But I think it's certainly something that's worthy of discussion. We know that the employment markets are changing, and we know that there are plenty of New Zealanders who are working beyond 65, and for them, some of them, they may well and truly sit there and say it's actually worth me taking it later. And another option, of course, is for them to continue to take money at 65 and invest it. But, you know, it's very, it's a little bit horses for courses.
But it's fair to say you're more open to it than in the past.
Yeah, well, certainly you should see what the feedback is.
Is that in any way payback for Mr. Dunn supporting the GCSB legislation?
No. It's part of the ongoing continuation of confidence in supply. I mean, if we didn't support this because we agreed this back in 2011, then effectively we'd be walking away from the confidence in supply.
I'm not talking about the discussion document, but your indications that you're slightly less uninterested.
No. I mean, I think there's some merit. I mean, Don Rashford started talking about this stuff, you remember some quite some time ago. He was actually quite keen on flexible super. It's not without its merit, so I'm just not sure whether we can actually get it to work and how much appeal will be there.
What's your view on the events in Sri Lanka and whether MFAT has the resources or the government is focusing enough on dealing with this?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that Fonterra are very focused on what's happening in Sri Lanka for obvious reasons. It's quite a big market from their point of view. I think that they are trying to formulate a plan that they might want to take to that market of how they can demonstrate long-term commitment and have a sounder operating platform in Sri Lanka. So look, in the end, I'll leave that to them to work their way through it. But I think they have decided on the back of everything that's taking place now that they need to take a step back, think about their longer-term strategy, and enact that.
More broadly, though, do you think MFAT has the resources to deal with these food safety issues, all the trade diplomacy that goes around that, given what's happened in the last couple of months?
There's some debate amongst ministers about whether we need to have a bigger footprint offshore in some of those critical markets. And if you think about China as an interesting market, I mean, we've gone from, in recent times, a couple of billion dollars worth of exports to, say, 7 billion now and rising rapidly. Maybe our footprint needs to be a bit bigger then.
So you're saying that we may have bigger staff at MFAT to cope with some of these challenges?
We may end up putting more people on market, yes.
Does that mean that your decisions last year to cut MFAT staff is a mistake?
No. I mean, you've got to think about what happened there. This was really a decision around the long-term structuring of MFAT and the way their contracts worked and how they could get renewal through their second tier. This is about how many specialist trade personnel in market they might have in locations and whether that footprint is right. And that's something that they'll need to work through with both MB and with MFAT. I'm saying they'll make that decision today, but I wouldn't be surprised over time if they decide they're going to build their capability. And certainly I know the foreign minister, when he was in China last week, was talking to the Chinese about the new chancery that's been built there, the embassy, the commitments to that market, and build a positive response in China.
Does that mean more funding for MFAT or just reshuffling?
We'll have to wait and see.
And the time frame for that discussion?
They'll continue to work on that reasonably quickly.
And which countries are you talking about after China?
Well, obviously they'll go away and look at the critical markets, but certainly China is a potential one, but it may have time for more.
When you say a bigger footprint offshore, what are we talking about here, 10, 20, 30?
I think it's very early days, but all I know is that there's been some discussions between the Trade Minister, the Economic Development Minister, and the Foreign Minister about exactly that footprint, whether it's big enough, whether enough people in market, whether we have enough resources to support everything. when there are, all, well, there will always be obvious issues that occur when you're a large exporting market. There just is.
Where do you think not having the right footprint now caused problems?
Well, we're in the process of going through, you know, a series of reviews in terms of the China situation and, you know, a general review of things. So I don't want to jump to that today. I think it's just a better for us to go away and reflect on what we've seen, take a considered view on that and see whether there's room for change.
Could it also be part of what the quality
assurance could be, I mean, well, I think, again, I wouldn't want to jump to conclusions, but one of those with part B and C of the government's inquiry is really looking in terms of the dairy industry about the wider issues of testing and assurance and traceability. And MPI, I think, are releasing their report to the Chinese, I think, in the next day or two, about the tracing issues up there, and that report will be released this week.
Wouldn't it have made it easier, though, if the government had retained some of those backroom heads, that staff, that then perhaps would have been able to assist and back up people and impact with these kind of situations? Doesn't that leave us with a hole?
No, I don't think that's actually right. I mean, we'll have to go and have a look at that, but I think the real argument, because the changes at MFAT were really around when people were not sure what jobs they were guaranteed back in New Zealand, what terms and conditions they went on. There was a whole range of different things, and there were pluses and minuses, but overall we wanted to encourage a system which could encourage different tiers of people coming in and make sure that people could see opportunities to progress and succeed in the organisation. So there were real merits there. I think there's within MVAT there are specialist areas and trade and market issues are quite a big subset there. And the question is, do we have enough people in that, contained in that footprink? And my guess is we might need to beef up a little bit in some markets.
On the Sapphire Forum, are you expecting the small island nations to complain about New Zealand's reduced emissions?
Well, the theme of the forum, you know, by the host nation, the Marshall Islands, is climate change, and President Leong's written an open letter on that, so of course it will be an issue that will be discussed just generally in climate change. But I mean, my view is that New Zealand has got nothing to be ashamed of and quite a lot to be proud of. I mean, we've obviously come out with our 2020 target, but our target is based off, you know, very consistent levels with other countries. 2050, 2020, but based on very consistent levels, I mean, it's still a bigger reduction than we're going to see in the United States and Australia and many other countries. We're doing a lot around science and we have an emissions trading scheme. So, I mean, look, we can talk our way through that, but I think we're in pretty good shape.
What message will you be taking about climate change?
Well, that New Zealand remains committed. I mean, we want to see a resolution to sort of Kyoto where all the players are participants. So, you know, I think it goes back to that most basic issue, and this is a global problem and it needs a global solution. And I think New Zealand doing something that's out of line with our other trading partners doesn't really seem to make sense to me. But we're quite prepared to do our bit, and I think in many areas we're doing more than our bit. And, you know, Global Greenhouse Gas Alliance, we've been doing through the Private Growth Partnership, all of those things are assisting greatly. But there's work to be done, not simply. I can get it for you. We obviously give them some aid. I don't know exactly off the top of my head.